It was a fierce thing to do, a reckless thing to do, and I ought to have asked Marius's permission, but I was, as I've told you, an unruly pupil. I had to do this. The wind gusted through the house. The huddled figures shivered and pushed their thick furs up around their shoulders. The fire deep in the mouth of the brick stove flared beautifully. I knew that I should remove my hat, which in this case was my hood, and that I should face the icon corner and cross myself, but I couldn't do this. In fact, to conceal myself, I pulled my hood up over my head as I shut the door. I stood alone against it. I held the fur cloak up against my mouth, so that nothing was visible of my face except my eyes, and perhaps a shock of reddish hair. "Why has the drink gotten Ivan?" I whispered, the old Russian tongue coming back to me. "Ivan was the strongest man in this city. Where is he now?" They were wary and angry at my intrusion. The fire in the stove crackled and danced from its feast of fresh air. The icon corner seemed a group of perfect radiant flames unto itself, with its brilliant images and random candles, another fire of a different and eternal sort. The face of Christ was clear to me in the fluttering light, the eyes seeming to fix me as I stood against the door. My uncle rose and shoved the harp into the arms of a younger boy I didn't know. I saw in the shadows the children sitting up in their heavily draped beds. I saw their shining eyes looking at me in the dark. The others in the firelight clumped together and faced me. I saw my mother, wizened and sad, as if centuries had passed since I left her, a veritable crone in the corner, clinging to the rug that covered her lap. I studied her, trying to fathom the cause of her decay. Toothless, decrepit, her knuckles big and chafed and shiny from work. Perhaps she was merely a woman being worked too rapidly towards her grave. A great collection of thoughts and words struck me, as if I were being pelted with blows. Angel, devil, night visitor, terror from the dark, what are you? I saw hands raised, hastily making the sign of the cross, but the thoughts came clear in answer to my query. Who does not know that Ivan the Hunter had become Ivan the Penitent, Ivan the Drunkard, Ivan the Mad, on account of the day in the wild lands when he couldn't stop the Tatars from kidnapping his beloved son, Andrei? I shut my eyes. It was worse than death what had happened to him. And I had never so much as wondered, never so much as dared to think of him alive, or cared enough to hope that he was, or thought what his fate might be had he lived. All over Venice were the shops in which I might have penned a letter to him, a letter that the great Venetian traders could have carried to some port, where it might have been delivered over the famous post-roads of the Khan. I knew all this. Selfish little Andrei knew all this, the details that might have sealed the past for him neatly so that he could have forgotten it. I might have written, "Family, I live and am happy, though I can never come home. Take this money I send to you for my brothers and sisters and my mother." But then I hadn't really ever known. The past had been misery and chaos. Whenever the most trivial picture had become vivid, then torment had reigned. My uncle stood before me. He was as big as my father, and was well dressed in a belted leather tunic and felt boots. He looked down at me calmly but severely. "Who are you that comes into our house in this manner?" he asked. "What is this prince that stands before us? You carry a message for us? Then speak, and we will forgive you that you broke the lock on our door." I drew in my breath. I had no more questions. I knew that I could find Ivan the Drunkard, that he was in the tavern with the fishermen and the fur traders, for that was the only enclosed place he'd ever loved other than his home. With my left hand, I reached over and found the purse that I always carried, tied, as it should be, to my belt. I ripped it loose and I handed it to this man. He merely looked at it. Then he drew himself up, offended, and he stepped back. He seemed then to become part of a deliberate picture with the house. I saw the house. I saw the hand-carved furniture, the pride of the family which had done it, the hand-carved wooden crosses and candlesticks which held the many candles. I saw the painted symbols decorating the wood frames of the windows, and the shelves on which fine homemade pots, kettles, and bowls were displayed. I saw them all in their pride, then, the entire family, the women with the embroidery, as well as those with mending, and I remembered with a lulling comfort the stability and the warmth of their daily life. Yet it was sad, oh, woefully sad, compared to the world I knew. I stepped forward and I held out the purse again to him, and I said in a muffled voice, still veiling my face, "I beg you to take this as a kindness to me, and that I might save my soul. It's from your nephew, André. He is far, far away, in the land to which the slave traders took him, and he will never come home. But he is well, and must share some of what he has with his family. He bids me to tell him which of you lives and which of you is dead. If I do not give you this money, and if you don't take it, I will be damned to hell." There came no response from them verbally, but I had what I wanted from their minds. I had all of it. Yes, Ivan was alive, and now I, this strange man, was saying that André lived too. Ivan mourned for a son who not only lived but prospered. Life is a tragedy, one way or another. What is certain is that you die. "I beg you," I said. My uncle took the proffered purse, but with misgivings. It was full of gold ducats, which would buy anywhere. I let my cloak drop, and I pulled off my left glove, and then the rings that covered every finger of my left hand. Opal, onyx, amethyst, topaz, turquoise. I moved past the man and the boys to the far side of the fire, and laid these respectfully in the lap of the old woman who had been my mother, as she looked up. I could see that, in a moment, she would know who I was. I covered my face again, but with my left hand I took my dagger from my belt. It was only a short misericord, the little dagger which a warrior takes into battle to dispatch his victims if they are too far gone for salvation, and yet not dead. It was a decorative thing, an ornament more than a weapon, and its gold-plated scabbard was thickly lined with perfect pearls. "For you," I said, "for André's mother, who always loved her necklace of river pearls. Take this for André's soul." I laid the dagger at my mother's feet. And then I made a deep, deep bow, with my head almost touching the floor, and I went out without looking back, closing the door behind me, and hovering near, to hear them as they jumped up and crowded about to see the rings and the dagger, and some to see to the lock. For a moment I was weak with emotion, but nothing was going to stop me from what I meant to do. I didn't turn to Marius, because it would have been craven to ask his support in this, or assent to it. I went on down the muddy, snowy street, through the sludge, towards the tavern nearest to the river, where I thought my father might be. I had rarely entered this place as a child, and then only to summon my father home. I had no real memory of it, except as a place where foreign people drank and cursed. It was a long building, made of the same rude, unfinished logs as my house, with the same mud for mortar, and the same inevitable seams and cracks to let in the dreadful cold. Its roof was very high, with some 6 tiers to shed the weight of the snow, and its eaves, too, dripped with icicles, as had those of my house. It marveled me that men could live like this, that the cold itself did not push them to make something more permanent and more sheltering. But it had always been the way of this place, it seemed to me, of the poor and the sick and overburdened and the hungry, that the brutal winter took too much from them, and that the short spring and summer gave them too little, and that resignation became their greatest virtue in the end. But I might have been wrong then about all of it, and I might be wrong now. What is important is this. It was a place of hopelessness, and though it was not ugly, for wood and mud and snow and sadness are not ugly, it was a place without beauty, except for the icons, and perhaps for the distant outline of the graceful domes of Santa Sofia, high on the hill, against the star-studded sky. And that was not enough. When I entered the tavern, I counted some 20 men at a glance, all of them drinking and talking to one another with a conviviality that surprised me, given the Spartan nature of this place, which was no more than a shelter against the night, which kept them safely ranged round the big fire. There were no icons here to comfort them, but some of them were singing, and there was the inevitable harp player strumming his little stringed instrument, and another blowing on a small pipe. There were many tables, some covered with linen, and others bare, at which these fellows gathered, and some of the men were foreigners, as I had recalled. 3 were Italian, I heard this instantly, and figured them to be Genoese. There were more foreigners, indeed, than I had expected. But these were men drawn by the trade of the river, and perhaps Kiev did not do so poorly just now. There were plenty of kegs of beer and wine behind the counter, where the bartender sold his stock by the cup. I saw too many bottles of Italian wine, quite expensive, no doubt, and crates of Spanish sack. Lest I attract notice, I moved forward and far off to the left, into the depth of the shadows, where perhaps a European traveler clad in rich fur might not be noticed, for, after all, fine fur was one thing they did indeed seem to have. These people were much too drunk to care who I was. The bartender tried to get excited about the idea of a new customer, but then went back to snoozing on the palm of his upturned hand. The music continued, another one of the doomy, and this one much less cheerful than the one my uncle had been singing at home, because I think the musician was very tired. I saw my father. He lay on his back, full length, on a broad, crude, greasy bench, dressed in his leather jerkin and with his biggest, heaviest fur cloak folded neatly over him, as though the others had done the honors with it after he had passed out. This was bearskin, his cloak, which marked him as a pretty rich man. He snored in his drunken sleep, and the fumes of the drink rose from him, and he didn't stir when I knelt right beside him and looked down into his face. His cheeks, though thinner, were still rosy, but there were hollows beneath the bones, and there were streaks of gray, most prominent in his mustache and long beard. It seemed to me that some of the hair of his temples was gone, and that his fine, smooth brow was steeper, but this may have been an illusion. The flesh all around his eyes was tender-looking and dark. His hands, clutched together beneath a cloak, were not visible to me, but I could see that he was still strong, of powerful build, and his love of drink had not destroyed him yet. I had a disturbing sense of his vitality suddenly. I could smell the blood of him and the life of him, as though of a possible victim stumbling across my path. I put all this away from my mind and stared at him, loving him and thinking only that I was so glad that he was alive. He had come out of the wild grasses. He had escaped that party of raiders who had seemed then the very heralds of death itself. I pulled up a stool so that I might sit quietly beside my father, studying his face. I had not put on my left glove. I laid my cold hand now on his forehead, lightly, not wanting to take liberties, and slowly he opened his eyes. They were murky, yet still beautifully bright, despite the broken blood vessels and the wetness, and he looked at me softly and wordlessly for a while, as if he had no cause to move, as if I were a vision near to his dreams. I felt the hood fall back from my head, and I did nothing to stop it. I couldn't see what he saw, but I knew what it was. His son, with a clean-shaven face, such as his son had had when this man knew him, and long, loose auburn hair in snow-dusted waves. Beyond, their bodies mere bulky outlines against the huge blaze of the fire, the others sang or talked, and the wine flowed. Nothing came between me and this moment, between me and this man who had tried hard to bring down the Tatars, who had sent one arrow after another sailing at his enemies, even as their arrows rained down upon him in vain. "They never wounded you," I whispered. "I love you, and only now do I know how strong you were." Was my voice even audible? He blinked as he looked at me, and then I saw his tongue roll out along his lips. His lips were bright like coral, shining through the heavy red fringe of mustache and beard. "They wounded me," he said in a low voice, small but not weak. "They got me, twice they got me, in the shoulder and in the arm. But they didn't kill me, and they didn't let go of André. I fell off my horse, I got up. They never got me in the legs. I ran after them. I ran and ran, and I kept shooting. I had a cursed arrow sticking right out of my right shoulder here." His hand appeared from beneath the fur, and he placed it up on the dark curve of his right shoulder. "I kept shooting. I didn't even feel it. I saw them right away. They took him. I don't even know if he was alive. I don't know. Would they have bothered to take him if they had shot him? There were arrows everywhere. The sky rained arrows. There must have been 50 of them. They killed every other man. I told the others, 'You have to keep shooting. Don't stop even for an instant. Don't cower. Shoot and shoot and shoot. And when you have no more arrows, bring up your sword and go for them. Ride straight into them. Get down close to your horse's head, and ride into them.' Well, maybe they did. I don't know." He lowered his lids. He glanced around. He wanted to get up, and then he looked at me. "Give me something to drink. Buy me something decent. The man has Spanish sack. Get me some of that. A bottle of sack. Hell, in the old days, I laid in wait for the traders out there in the river, and I never had to buy anything from any man. Get me a bottle of sack. I can see you're rich. Do you know who I am? I asked. He looked at me in plain confusion. This hadn't even occurred to him, this question. You come from the castle. You speak with the accent of the Lithuanians. I don't care who you are. Buy me some wine. With the accent of the Lithuanians? I asked softly. What a dreadful thing. I think it's the accent of a Venetian, and I'm ashamed.
Venetian? Well, don't be. God knows they tried to save Constantinople. They tried. Everything's gone to hell. The world will end in flame. Get me some sack before it ends, all right?
I stood up. Did I have some more money? I was puzzling over it when the dark, silent figure of my master loomed over me, and he handed me the bottle of Spanish sack, uncorked and ready for my father to drink. I sighed. The smell of it meant nothing to me now, but I knew that it was fine, good stuff, and besides, it was what he wanted. He had meantime sat up on the bench, staring straight at the bottle as it hung from my hand. He reached out for it, and took it, and drank it as thirstily as I drink blood. "Take a good look at me," I said.
"It's too dark in here, idiot," he said. "How can I take a good look at anything? But this is good. Thank you."
Suddenly, he paused with the bottle just beneath his lips. It was a strange thing, the way in which he paused. It was as if he were in the forest, and he just sensed a bear coming up on him, or some other lethal beast. He froze, as it were, with the bottle in hand, and only his eyes moved as he looked up at me.
"André," he whispered.
"I'm alive, father," I said gently. "They didn't kill me. They took me for booty and sold me for profit. And I was taken by ship south and north again, and up to the city of Venice, and that is where I live now." His eyes were calm. Indeed, a beautiful serenity settled over him. He was far too drunk for his reason to revolt, or for cheap surprise to delight him. On the contrary, the truth stole in and over him in a wave, subduing him, and he understood all of its ramifications, that I had not suffered, that I was rich, I was well. "I was lost, sir," I said in the same gentle whisper, which surely was only audible to him. "I was lost, yes, but found by another, a kindly man, and was restored, and have never suffered since. I've journeyed a long time to tell you this, father. I never knew you were alive. I never dreamed. I thought you died that day when all the world died for me. And now I'm come here to tell you that you must never, never grieve for me."
"André," he whispered,
but there was no change in his face. There was only the sedate wonder. He sat still, both hands on the bottle which he had lowered to his lap, his huge shoulders very straight, and his flowing red and gray hair, as long as I'd ever seen it, melting into the fur of his cloak. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. I needed a monster's eyes to know it. I needed a demon's vision to see the strength in his eyes, coupled with the power in his giant frame. Only the bloodshot eyes gave him away in his weakness.
"Forget me now, father," I said. "Forget me as if the monks had sent me away. But remember this. On account of you, I shall never be buried in the muddy graves of the monastery. No, other things may befall me, but that I won't suffer, because of you, that you wouldn't have it, that you came that day and demanded I ride out with you, that I be your son."
I turned to go. He shot forward, clasping the bottle by the neck in his left hand and clamping his powerful right hand over my wrist. He pulled me down to him, as if I were a mere mortal, with his old strength, and he pressed his lips against my bowed head. Oh, God, don't let him know. Don't let him sense any change in me. I was desperate. I closed my eyes. But I was young, and not so hard and cold as my master. No, not even by half, or a half of that half. And he felt only the softness of my hair, and perhaps a cold, icy softness, redolent of winter, to my skin.
"André, my angel child, my gifted and golden son."
I turned around and clasped him firmly with my left arm.
I kissed him all over his head, in a way I would never, never have done as a child. I held him to my heart. "Father, don't drink any more," I said in his ear. "Get up and be the hunter again. Be what you are, father."
"André, no one will ever believe me."
"And who are they to say that to you if you are yourself again, man?" I asked. We looked into each other's eyes. I kept my lips sealed, that he should never, never see the sharp teeth in my mouth that the vampiric blood had given me, the tiny, evil vampire's teeth. As a man as keen as himself, the natural hunter might very definitely see. But he was looking for no such disqualification here. He wanted only love, and love we gave one another. "I have to go. I have no choice," I said. "I stole this time to come to you. Father, tell my mother that it was I who came to the house earlier, and that it was I who gave her the rings and gave your brother the purse." I drew back. I sat down on the bench beside him, for he had placed his feet on the floor. I pulled off my right glove, and I looked at the 7 or 8 rings I wore, all of them made of gold or silver and rich with jewels, and then I slipped them off one by one over his loud groan of protest, and I deposited the handful of them into his hand. How soft and hot was his hand, how flushed and alive. "You take them because I have a world of them, and I will write to you and send you more, more so that you will never need to do anything but what you want to do, ride and hunt, and tell the tales of old times by the fire. Buy a fine harp with this, buy books, if you will, for the little ones, buy what you will."
"I don't want this. I want you, my son."
"Yes, and I want you, my father, but this little power is all we may have." I took his head in both my hands, displaying my strength, perhaps unwisely, but making him stay still while I gave him my kisses, and then with one long, warm embrace, I rose to go. I was out of the room so fast he couldn't have seen anything but the door swinging shut. The snow was coming down. I saw my master several yards away, and I went to meet him, and together we started up the hill. I didn't want my father to come out. I wanted to get away as fast as I could. I was about to ask that we take to vampire speed and get clear of Kiev, when I saw that a figure was hurrying towards us. It was a small woman, her long, heavy furs trailing in the wet snow. She had something bright in her arms. I stood fixed, my master waiting on me. It was my mother who had come to see me. It was my mother who was making her way to the tavern. And in her arms, facing me, was an icon of the scowling Christ, the one I looked at so long through the chink in the wall of the house. I drew in my breath. She lifted the icon by either side, and she presented it to me.
"André," she whispered.
"Mother," I said, "keep it for the little ones, please." I embraced her and kissed her. How much older, how miserably older she seemed. But childbearing had done that to her, pulling the strength out of her, if only for babies to be buried in small plots in the ground. I thought of how many babies she had lost during my youth, and how many were still counted before I was born. She had called them her angels, her little babies, not big enough to live. "Keep it," I said to her. "Keep it for the family here."
"All right, André," she said.
She looked at me with pale, suffering eyes. I could see that she was dying. I understood suddenly that it wasn't mere age that worked on her, nor the hardship of children. She was diseased from within, and would soon truly die. I felt such a terror looking at her, such a terror for the whole mortal world. It was just a tiresome, common, and inevitable disease. "Goodbye, darling angel," I said.
"And goodbye to you, my darling angel," she answered. "My heart and soul are happy that you are a proud prince. But show me, do you make the sign of the cross in the right way?"
How desperate she sounded. She meant these words. She meant simply, had I gotten all this apparent wealth by converting to the Church of the West? That is what she meant. "Mother, you put a simple test to me." I made the sign of the cross for her, in our way, the Eastern way, from right shoulder to left, and I smiled. She nodded. Then she took something carefully from inside her heavy wool shift coat, and she gave it to me, only releasing it when I had made a cradle for it with my hand. It was a dark, ruby-red painted Easter egg. Such a perfect and exquisitely decorated egg.
It was banded with long, lengthwise ribbons of yellow, and in a center, created by them, was painted a perfect rose, or eight-pointed star. I looked down at it, and then I nodded at her. I took out a handkerchief of fine Flemish linen, and wrapped the egg in this, patting it over and over, and I slipped a little burden faithfully into the folds of my tunic, beneath my jacket and cloak. I bent over and kissed her again on her soft, dry cheek.
"Mother," I said, "the joy of all sorrows, that is what you are to me."
"My sweet André," she answered, "go with God if you must go."
She looked at the icon. She wanted me to see it. She turned the icon around so that I could look at the gleaming, golden face of God, as waxen and fine as the day I'd painted it for her. Only I hadn't painted it for her. No, it was the very icon which I had taken that day on our march into the wild lands. Oh, what a marvel that my father had brought it back with him, all the way from the scene of such loss. And yet why not? Why would not such a man as he have done such a thing? The snow fell onto the painted icon. It fell on the stern face of our Savior, which had come ablaze under my racing brush as if by magic. A face which, with its stern and smooth lips and slightly furrowed brow, meant love. Christ my Lord could look even more stern peering out from the mosaics of San Marco. Christ my Lord could look as stern in many an old painting. But Christ my Lord, in any manner and in any style, was full of unstinting love. The snow came in flurries and seemed to melt when it touched his face. I feared for it, this fragile panel of wood, and this glistering, lacquered image meant to shine for all time. But she thought of this too, and she quickly shielded the icon from the wetness of the melting snow with her cloak. I never saw it again. But is there anyone who needs now to ask me what an icon means to me? Is there anyone who needs now to know why, when I saw the face of Christ before me on the veil of Veronica, when Dora held it high, this veil, brought back from Jerusalem and the hour of Christ's passion by Lestat himself, through hell and into the world, that I fell down on my knees and cried, "It is the Lord." Chapter 11. The journey from Kiev seemed a journey forwards in time, towards the place where I truly belonged. All of Venice, upon my return, seemed to share the shimmer of the gold-plated chamber in which I made my grave. In a daze, I spent my nights roaming, with or without Marius, drinking up the fresh air of the Adriatic, and perusing the splendid houses and government palaces to which I'd grown accustomed over the last few years. Evening church services drew me like honey draws flies. I drank up the music of the choirs, the chanting of the priests, and above all, the joyous, sensual attitude of the worshippers, as if all this would be a healing balm to those parts of me that were skinned and raw from my return to the monastery of the caves. But in my heart of hearts, I reserved a tenacious and heated flame of reverence for the Russian monks of the monastery of the caves. Having glimpsed a few words of the sainted Brother Isaac, I walked in the living memory of his teachings. Brother Isaac, who had been a fool for God, and a hermit, and a seer of spirits, the victim of the devil, and then his conqueror in the name of Christ. I had a religious soul, there was no doubt of it, and I had been given two great modes of religious thought. And now, in surrendering to a war between these modes, I made war on myself. For though I had no intention of giving up the luxuries and glories of Venice, the ever-shining beauty of Fra Angelico's lessons, and the stunning and gilded accomplishments of all those who followed him, making beauty for Christ, I secretly beatified the loser in my battle, the blessed Isaac, whom I imagined in my childish mind to have taken the true path to the Lord. Marius knew of my struggle. He knew of the hold which Kiev had upon me, and he knew of the crucial importance of all this to me. He understood better than anyone I've ever known that each being wars with his own angels and devils. Each being succumbs to an essential set of values, a theme, as it were, which is inseparable from living a proper life. For us, life was the vampiric life, but it was in every sense life, and sensuous life, and fleshly life. I could not escape into it from the compulsions and obsessions I'd felt as a mortal boy. On the contrary, they were now magnified.
Within the month after my return, I knew I had set the tone for my approach to the world around me. I should wallow in the luscious beauty of Italian painting and music and architecture, yes, but I would do it with the fervor of a Russian saint. I would turn all sensuous experiences to goodness and purity. I would learn, I would increase understanding, I would increase in compassion for the mortals around me, and I would never cease to put a pressure upon my soul to be that which I believed was good. Good was above all kind. It was to be gentle. It was to waste nothing. It was to paint, to read, to study, to listen, even to pray, though to whom I prayed I wasn't sure, and it was to take every opportunity to be generous to those mortals whom I did not kill. As for those I killed, they were to be dispatched mercifully, and I was to become the absolute master of mercy, never causing pain and confusion, indeed snaring my victims as much as I could by spells induced by my soft voice, or the depths of my eyes offered for soulful looks, or by some other power I seemed to possess and seemed able to develop, a power to thrust my mind into that of the poor, helpless mortal, and to assist him in the manufacture of his own comforting images, so that the death became the flicker of a flame in a rapture, and then silence most sweet. I also concentrated on enjoying the blood, on moving deeper, beneath the turbulent necessity of my own thirst, to taste this vital fluid of which I robbed my victim, and to feel most fully that which it carried with it to ultimate doom, the destiny of a mortal soul. My lessons with Marius were broken off for a while, but at last he came to me gently and told me it was time to study again in earnest, that there were things that we must do. "I make my own study," I said. "You know it well enough. You know I haven't been idle in my wanderings, and you know my mind is as hungry as my body. You know it, so leave me alone." "That's all well and good, little master," he said to me kindly, "but you must come back into the school I keep for you. I have things which you must know." For 5 nights I put him off. Then, as I was dozing on his bed sometime after midnight, having spent the earlier evening in the Piazza San Marco at a great festival, listening to musicians and watching the jugglers, I was startled to feel his switch come crashing down on the back of my legs. "Wake up, child," he said. I turned over and looked up. I was startled. He stood holding the long switch with his arms folded. He wore a long belted tunic of purple velvet, and his hair was tied back at the base of his neck. I turned away from him. I figured he was being dramatic and that he would go away. The switch came crashing down again, and this time there followed a volley of blows. I felt the blows in a way I'd never felt them when mortal. I was stronger, more resistant to them, but for a split second each blow broke through my preternatural guard and caused a tiny, exquisite explosion of pain. I was furious. I tried to climb up off the bed, and probably would have struck him, so angry was I to be treated in this manner. But he placed his knee on my back and whipped me over and over with the switch until I cried out. Then he stood up and dragged me up by the collar. I was shaking with rage and with confusion. "Want some more?" he asked. "I don't know," I said, throwing off his arm, which he allowed with a little smile. "Perhaps so. One minute my heart is of the greatest concern to you, and the next I'm a schoolboy. Is that it?" "You've had enough time to grieve and to weep," he said, "and to reevaluate all you've been given. Now it's back to work. Go to the desk and prepare to write, or I'll whip you some more." I flew into a tirade. "I'm not going to be treated this way. There's absolutely no necessity for this. What should I write? I've written volumes in my soul. You think you can force me into the dreary little mold of an obedient pupil? You think this is appropriate to the cataclysmic thoughts that I have to ponder? You think—" He smacked me across the face. I was dizzy. As my eyes cleared, I looked into his. "I want your attention again. I want you to come out of your meditation. Go to the desk and write for me a summary of what your journey to Russia meant to you, and what you see now here that you could not see before. Make it concise, use your finest similes and metaphors, and write it cleanly and quickly for me." "Such crude tactics," I muttered. But my body was throbbing from the blows. It was altogether different from the pain of a mortal body, but it was bad, and I hated it. I sat down at the desk. I was going to write something really churlish, such as, "I've learned that I'm the slave of a tyrant."
but when I looked up and saw him standing there with a switch in his hand, I changed my mind. He knew it was the perfect moment to come to me and kiss me, and he did this, and I realized I had lifted my face for his kiss before he bent his head. This didn't stop him. I felt the overwhelming happiness of giving in to him. I put my arm up and around his shoulders. He let me go after a long, sweet moment, and then I did write out many sentences, pretty much describing what I've explained above. I wrote about the battle in me between the fleshly and the ascetic. I wrote of my Russian soul as seeking after the highest level of exaltation. In the painting of the icon, I had found it, but the icon had satisfied the need for the sensual because the icon was beautiful. And as I wrote, I realized for the first time that the old Russian style, the antique Byzantine style, embodied a struggle in itself between the sensual and the ascetic, the figures suppressed, flattened, disciplined, in the very midst of rich color, the whole giving forth pure delight to the eyes, while representing denial. While I wrote, my master went away. I was aware of it, but it didn't matter. I was deep into my writing, and gradually I slipped out of my analysis of things and began to tell an old tale. In the old days, when the Russians didn't know Jesus Christ, the great Prince Vladimir of Kiev, and in those days Kiev was a magnificent city, sent his emissaries to study the three religions of the Lord, the Muslim religion, which these men found to be frantic and foul-smelling, the religion of Papal Rome, in which these men did not find any glory, and finally, the Christianity of Byzantium. In the city of Constantinople, the Russians were led to see the magnificent churches in which the Greek Catholics worshipped their God, and they found these buildings so beautiful that they didn't know whether they were in heaven or still on earth. Never had the Russians seen anything so splendid. They were certain then that God dwelt among men in the religion of Constantinople. And so it was this Christianity which Russia embraced. It was beauty, therefore, that gave birth to our Russian church. In Kiev, once men could find what Vladimir sought to recreate, but now that Kiev is a ruin and the Turks have taken Santa Sophia of Constantinople, one must come to Venice to see the great Theotokos, the Virgin who is the God-bearer, and her son when he becomes the Pantocrator, the divine creator of all. In Venice I have found, in sparkling gold mosaics, and in the muscular images of a new age, the very miracle which brought the light of Christ our Lord to the land where I was born, the light of Christ our Lord which burns still in the lamps of the Monastery of the Caves. I put down the pen, I pushed the page aside, and I laid my head down on my arms, and cried softly to myself in the quiet of the shadowy bedroom. I didn't care if I was beaten, kicked, or ignored. Finally, Marius came for me to take me to our crypt, and I realize now, centuries later, as I look back, that his forcing me to write on this night caused me to remember always the lessons of those times. The next night, after he'd read what I had written, he was contrite about having hit me, and he said that it was difficult for him to treat me as anything but a child, but that I was not a child. Rather, I was some spirit like unto a child, naive and maniacal in my pursuit of certain themes. He had never expected to love me so much. I wanted to be aloof and distant on account of the whipping, but I couldn't be. I marveled that his touch, his kisses, his embraces meant more to me than they had when I was human. Chapter 12. I wish I could slip away now from the happy picture of Marius and me in Venice and take up this tale in New York City in modern times. I want to go to the moment in the room in New York City when Dora held up Veronica's veil, the relic brought back by Lestat from his journey into the Inferno, for then I would have a tale told in two perfect halves, of the child I had been and of the worshipper I became, and of the creature I am now. But I cannot fool myself so easily. I know that what happened to Marius and to me in the months that followed my journey to Russia is part and parcel of my life. There is nothing to do but cross the bridge of sighs in my life, the long, dark bridge spanning centuries of my tortured existence, which connects me to modern times. That my time in this passage has been described so well already by Lestat doesn't mean that I can escape without adding my own words, and above all, my own acknowledgment of the fool for God that I was to be for 300 years. I wish I had escaped this fate. I wish that Marius had escaped what happened to us. It is plain now that he survived our separation with far greater insight and strength than I survived it. But then he was already centuries old and a wise being, and I was still a child. Our last months in Venice were unmarred by any premonition of what was to come. Vigorously, he taught me the essential lessons. One of the most important of these was how to pass for human in the midst of human beings. In all the time since my transformation, I had not kept good company with the other apprentices, and I had avoided altogether my beloved Bianca, to whom I owed a vast debt of gratitude, not merely for past friendship, but for nursing me when I was so ill. Now I had to face Bianca, or so Marius decreed. I was the one who had to write a polite letter to her, explaining that on account of my illness I had not been able to come to her before. Then, one evening, early, after a brief hunt in which I drank the blood of 2 victims, we set out to visit her, laden with gifts for her, and found her surrounded by her English and Italian friends. Marius had dressed for the occasion in smart, dark blue velvet, with a cloak of the same color for once, which was unusual for him, and he had urged me to dress in sky blue, his favorite color for me. I carried the wine figs and sweet tarts in a basket for her. We found her door open as always, and we entered unobtrusively, but she saw us at once. The moment I saw her, I felt a heartbreaking desire for a certain kind of intimacy. That is, I wanted to tell her everything that had happened. Of course this was forbidden, and that I could love her without confiding in her. This was something that Marius insisted I learn. She got up and came to me, and put her arms around me, accepting the usual ardent kisses. I realized at once why Marius had insisted on 2 victims for this evening. I was warm and flushed with blood. Bianca felt nothing that frightened her. She slipped her silken arms around my neck. She was radiant in a dress of yellow silk tissue and dark green velvet, the underdress of yellow, powdered with embroidered roses, and her white breasts were barely covered, as only a courtesan would have them. When I began to kiss her, careful to conceal my tiny fanged teeth from her, I felt no hunger, because the blood of my victims had been more than enough. I kissed her with love, and love only, my mind quickly plunging into heated, erotic memories, my body surely demonstrating the urgency that it had had with her in the past. I wanted to touch her all over, as a blind man might touch a sculpture, the better to see each curve of her with his hands.
"Oh, you're not only well, you're splendid," Bianca said. "You and Marius, come in, come. Let's go into the next room."
She made a careless gesture to her guests, who were all busy anyway, talking, arguing, playing cards in small groups. She drew us with her into her more intimate parlor adjacent to the bedroom, a room cluttered with frightfully expensive damask chairs and couches, and told me to sit down. I remembered the candles, that I must never get too close to them, but must use the shadows so no mortal would have an optimum opportunity to study my changed and more perfect skin. This wasn't so hard, as, in spite of her love of light and her penchant for luxury, she had the candelabra scattered for the mood. The lack of light would also make the sparkle of my eyes less noticeable. I knew this, too. And the more I spoke, the more animated I became, the more human I would appear. Stillness was dangerous for us when we were among mortals, Marius had taught me, for in stillness we appear flawless and unearthly, and finally even faintly horrible to mortals, who sense that we are not what we seem. I followed all these rules, but I was overcome with anxiety that I could never tell her what had been done to me. I started to talk. I explained that the illness had abated entirely, but that Marius, wiser by far than any physician, had ordered solitude and rest. When I had not been in bed, I had been alone, struggling to regain my strength. "Make it as near to the truth as you can, the better to make it a lie," Marius had taught. Now I followed these words.
"Oh, but I thought I'd lost you," she said. "When you sent word, Marius, that he was recovering, I didn't at first believe you. I thought you meant to soften the inevitable truth."
How lovely she was, a perfect flower. Her blonde hair was parted in the middle, and a thick lock on either side was wound with pearls and bound back with a clasp encrusted with them. The rest of her hair fell down a la Botticelli, in rivulets of shining yellow over her shoulders.
You had cured him as completely as any human being could, Marius told her. My task was to give him some old remedies of which only I know, and then to let the remedies do their work. He spoke simply, but to me he seemed sad. A terrible sadness gripped me. I couldn't tell her what I was, or how different she seemed now, how richly opaque with human blood she seemed compared to us, and how her voice had taken on for me a new timbre that was purely human, and which gently nudged my senses if she but said one word.
"Well, you are both here, and you must both come often," she said. "Don't ever let such a separation occur again. Marius, I would have come to you, but Ricardo told me you wanted peace and quiet. I would have nursed Amadeo in any state."
"I know you would have, my darling," Marius said, "but as I said, it was solitude he needed, and your beauty is an intoxicant, and your words a stimulus, more intense perhaps than you realize." It had no tone of flattery, but sounded like a sincere confession. She shook her head a little sadly.
"I've discovered that Venice is not my home unless you're here."
She looked cautiously towards the front parlor, and then she lapsed into a low voice.
"Marius, you freed me from those who had a hold on me."
"That was simple enough," he said. "It was a pleasure, in fact. How rank those men were. Cousins of yours, if I'm not mistaken, and eager to use you and your great reputation for beauty in their twisted financial affairs." She blushed, and I lifted my hand to beg him to go easy with what he said. I knew now that during the slaughter of the Florentine banquet chamber, he had read from the victims' minds all kinds of things which were unknown to me.
"Cousins? Perhaps," she said. "I have conveniently forgotten that they were a terror to those whom they lured into expensive loans and dangerous opportunities. That I can say without a doubt. Marius, the strangest things have happened, things upon which I never counted."
I loved the look of seriousness on her delicate features. She seemed too beautiful to have a brain.
"I find myself richer," she said, "as I can keep the larger portion of my own income, and others, this is the strange part, others, in gratitude that our banker and our extortionist is gone, have lavished on me countless gifts of gold and jewels, yes, even this necklace, look. And you know these are all sea pearls, and matched in size. And this is a veritable rope of them, see? And all this is given me, though I have averred 100 times that I never had the deed done."
"But what of blame?" I asked. "What of the danger of a public accusation?"
"They have no defenders or mourners," she said quickly.
She planted another little bouquet of kisses on my cheek.
"And earlier today, my friends among the great council were here, as always, to read a few new poems to me and settle in quiet where they could know peace from clients and the endless demands of their families. No, I don't think anyone is going to accuse me of anything. And as everyone knows, on the night of the murders, I was here in company with that awful Englishman, Amadeo, the very one who tried to kill you, who has, of course..."
"Yes? What?" I asked. Marius narrowed his eyes and looked at me. He made a light gesture of tapping the side of his head with his gloved finger. "Read her mind," he meant, but I couldn't think of such a thing. Her face was too pretty.
"The Englishman," she said, "who has disappeared. I suspect he's drowned somewhere, that, staggering drunk about the town, he fell into one of the canals, or, worse yet, into the lagoon."
Of course my master had told me that he had taken care of all our difficulties on account of the Englishman, but I had never asked in what particular way. "So they think you hired killers to dispatch the Florentines?" Marius asked her.
"Seems so," she said, "and there are even those who think that I had the Englishman dispatched as well. I've become a rather powerful woman, Marius."
Both of them laughed, his laugh the deep but metallic laugh of a preternatural being, and her laugh higher yet thicker with the sound of her human blood. I wanted to go into her mind. I tried, but cast away the idea at once. I was inhibited, just as I was with Ricardo and the boys closest to me. In fact, it seemed such a terrible invasion of the privacy of the person that I used this power only in hunting to find those who were evil and whom I might kill.
"Amadeo, you blush. What is it?" Bianca asked. "Your cheeks are scarlet. Let me kiss them. Oh, You are hot as if the fever has come back.
Look into his eyes, Angel, said Marius. They are clear.
You're right, she said,
peering into my eyes with such a sweet, frank curiosity that she became irresistible to me. I pushed back the yellow cloth of her underdress and the heavy velvet of her dark green sleeveless overgarment and kissed her bare shoulder.
Yes, you're well,
she cooed into my ear, her lips moist against it. I was blushing still as I drew back. I looked at her, and I went into her mind. It seemed I had loosened the golden clasp beneath her breasts and parted her voluminous, dark-green velvet skirts. I stared at the well between her half-exposed breasts. Blood or no blood, I could remember hot passion for her, and I felt it now in a strange, overall manner, not localized in the forgotten organ as it had been before. I wanted to take her breasts in my hands and suckle them slowly, arousing her, making her moist and fragrant for me, and making her head fall back. Yes, I blushed. A dim, sweet swoon came over me. I want you. I want you now. You and Marius both in my bed, together, a man and a boy, a god and a cherub. This is what her mind was saying to me, and she was remembering me. I saw myself as if in a smoky mirror, a boy naked, except for a full-sleeved open shirt, seated on the pillows beside her, displaying the half-erect organ, ever ready to be completely aroused by her tender lips or her long, graceful white hands. I banished all this. I focused my gaze only on her beautiful, tapering eyes. She studied me, not suspiciously, but in fascination. Her lips were not rouged in any vulgar manner, but deeply pink by nature, and her long lashes, darkened and curled only with a clear pomade, looked like the points of stars around her radiant eyes. I want you. I want you now. These were her thoughts. They struck my ears. I bowed my head and put my hands up.
Angel, darling, she said. Both of you,
she whispered to Marius. She took my hands.
Come in with me.
I was certain he would put a stop to it. He had cautioned me to avoid close scrutiny, but he only rose from his chair and moved towards her bedchamber, pushing back the two painted doors. From the distant parlors came the steady sound of conversation and laughter. Singing had been added. Someone played the virginal. All this went on. We slipped into her bed. I was shaking all over. I saw that my master had adorned himself in a thick tunic and beautiful dark blue doublet, which I'd hardly noticed before. He wore soft, sleek, dark blue gloves over his hands, gloves which perfectly cleaved to his fingers, and his legs were covered by thick, soft cashmere stockings, all the way to his beautiful, pointed shoes. He has covered all the hardness, I thought. Having settled against the headboard of the bed, he had no compunction about helping Bianca to sit directly next to him. I looked across from him as I took my place beside her. As she turned to me, putting her hands on my face and kissing me eagerly, I saw him perform a small act which I hadn't seen before. Lifting her hair, he appeared to kiss her on the back of the neck. This she neither felt nor acknowledged. When he drew back, however, his lips were bloody, and lifting the finger of his gloved hand, he smoothed this blood, her blood, but a few droplets of it from a shallow scratch, undoubtedly, all over his face. It appeared to me as a living sheen, and to her it would look very different. It quickened the pores in his skin, which had become all but invisible, and it deepened a few lines around his eyes and his mouth, which otherwise were lost. It gave him a more human look, overall, and served as a barrier to her gaze, which was now so close.
"I have my two, as I always dreamed," she said softly.
Marius came round in front of her, tucking his arm behind her, and began to kiss her as greedily as I had ever done. I was astonished for a moment, and jealous, but then her free hand found me and pulled me down close to her, and she turned from Marius, dazed with desire, and kissed me as well. Marius reached over and brought me close to her, so that I was against her soft curves, feeling all the warmth rising from her voluptuous thighs. He lay on top of her, but lightly, not letting his weight hurt her, and with his right hand he drew up her skirt and moved his fingers between her legs. It was so bold. I lay against her shoulder, looking at the swell of her breasts,
and beyond that the tiny, down-covered mound of her sex, which he clasped in his entire hand. She was past all decorum. He laid kisses on her neck and on her breasts as he embraced her lower down with his fingers, and she began to writhe with undisguised longing, her mouth open, her eyelids fluttering, her body suddenly moist all over and fragrant with this new heat. That was the miracle, I realized, that a human could be brought to this higher temperature, and thereby give forth all of her sweet scents, and even a strong, invisible shimmer of emotions. It was rather like stoking a fire until it became a blaze. The blood of my victims teemed in my face as I kissed her. It seemed to become living blood again, heated by my passion, and yet my passion had no demonic focus. I pressed my open mouth to the skin of her throat, covering the place where the artery showed like a blue river moving down from her head. But I didn't want to hurt her. I felt no need to hurt her. Indeed, I felt only pleasure as I embraced her, as I slipped my arm between her and Marius, so that I could cradle her tightly as he continued to toy with her, his fingers lifting and falling on the tender little mound of her sex.
"You tease me, Marius,"
she whispered, her head tossing. The pillow was damp beneath her and drenched with the perfume of her hair. I kissed her lips. They locked to my mouth. To keep her tongue from discovering my vampiric teeth, I drove my tongue into her. Her nether mouth couldn't have been sweeter, tighter, more moist. "Ah, then this, my sweet," said Marius tenderly, his fingers sliding inside her. She lifted her hips, as though the fingers were lifting her as she would have them do.
"Oh, heaven help me,"
she whispered, and then came the fullness of her passion, her face darkening with blood and the rosy fire spreading down her breasts. I pushed back the cloth and saw the redness consume her bosom, her nipples standing rigid in tiny, raisin-like points. I closed my eyes and lay beside her. I let myself feel the passion rock her, and then the heat was lessened in her, and she seemed to become sleepy. She turned her head away. Her face was still. Her eyelids were beautifully molded over her closed eyes. She sighed, and her pretty lips parted in a natural way. Marius brushed her hair back from her face, smoothing the tiny, unruly ringlets that were caught in the moisture, and then he kissed her forehead. "Sleep now, knowing you're safe," he said to her. "I'll take care of you forever." "You saved Amadeo," he whispered. "You kept him alive until I could come." Dreamily she turned to look up at him, her eyes glossy and slow.
"Am I not beautiful enough for you to love me for that alone?" she asked.
I realized suddenly that what she said was bitter, and that she was bestowing a confidence on him. I could feel her thoughts.
"I love you whether or not you dress in gold or wear pearls, whether or not you speak wittily and quickly, whether or not you make a well-lighted and elegant place in which I can rest. I love you for the heart here inside you, which came to Amadeo when you knew there was danger, that those who knew or loved the Englishman might hurt you. I love you for courage, and for what you know of being alone."
Her eyes widened for a moment.
"For what I know of being alone? Oh, I know very well what it means to be utterly alone."
"Yes, brave one, and now you know I love you," he whispered. "You always knew that Amadeo loved you."
"Yes, I do love you," I whispered, lying next to her, holding her.
"Well, now you know I love you as well."
She studied him as best she could in her languor.
"There are so many questions on the tip of my tongue," she said.
"They don't matter," Marius said. He kissed her, and I think he let his teeth touch her tongue. "I take all your questions and I cast them away. Sleep now, virginal heart," he said. "Love whom you will, quite safe in the love we feel for you."
It was the signal to withdraw. As I stood at the foot of the bed, he placed the embroidered covers over her, careful to fold the fine Flemish linen sheet over the edge of the rougher white wool blanket, and then he kissed her again, but she was like a little girl, soft and safe, and fast asleep. Outside, as we stood on the edge of the canal, he lifted his gloved hand to his nostrils, and he savored the fragrance of her on it.
"You have learned much today, haven't you? You cannot tell her anything of who you are. But do you see how close you might come?"
"Yes," I said.
but only if I want nothing in return.
Nothing? He asked. He looked at me reprovingly. She gave you loyalty, affection, intimacy. What more could you want in return?
Nothing now, I said. You've taught me well. But what I had before was her understanding, that she was a mirror in which I could study my reflection and thereby judge my own growth. She can't be that mirror now, can she?
Yes, in many ways she can. Show her by gestures and simple words what you are. You needn't tell her tales of blood drinkers that would only drive her mad. She can comfort you marvelously well without ever knowing what hurts you. And you must remember that to tell her everything would be to destroy her. Imagine it. I was silent for a long moment.
Something's occurred to you, he said. You have that solemn look. Speak. Can she be made into what we...
Amadeo, you bring me to another lesson. The answer is no.
But she'll grow old and die and...
Of course she will, as she is meant to do.
Amadeo, how many of us can there be? And on what grounds would we bring her over to us? And would we want her as our companion forever? Would we want her as our pupil? Would we want to hear her cries if the magic blood were to drive her mad?
It is not for any soul, this blood, Amadeo. It demands a great strength and a great preparation, all of which I found in you. But I do not see it in her.
I nodded. I knew what he meant. I didn't have to think over all that had befallen me, or even think back to the rude cradle of Russia where I'd been nursed. He was right.
You will want to share this power with them all, he said. Learn that you cannot. Learn that with each one you make there comes a terrible obligation and a terrible danger. Children rise against their parents, and with each blood drinker made by you, you make a child that will live forever, in love for you, or hate. Yes, hate.
You needn't say any more, I whispered. I know. I understand.
We went home together, to the brightly lighted rooms of the palazzo. I knew then what he wanted of me, that I mingle with my old friends among the boys, that I show kindness in particular to Ricardo, who blamed himself, I soon realized, for the death of those few undefended ones whom the Englishman had murdered on that fateful day. Pretend and grow strong with each pretense, he whispered in my ear. Rather, draw close and be loving and love, without the luxury of complete honesty, for love can bridge all.
Chapter 13. In the following months I learned more than I can ever recount here. I studied vigorously and paid attention even to the government of the city, which I thought basically as tiresome as any government, and read voraciously the great Christian scholars, completing my time with Abelard, Duns Scotus, and other thinkers whom Marius prized. Marius also found for me a heap of Russian literature, so that for the first time I could study in writing what I had only known from the songs of my uncles and my father in the past. At first I deemed this too painful for a serious inquiry, but Marius laid down the law, and wisely. The inherent value of the subject matter soon absorbed my painful recollections, and a greater knowledge and understanding was the result. All of these documents were in Church Slavonic, the written language of my childhood, and I soon fell into reading this with extraordinary ease. The lay of Igor's campaigns delighted me, but I also loved the writings, translated from the Greek, of St. John Chrysostom. I also reveled in the fantastical tales of King Solomon and of the descent of the Virgin into hell, works which were not part of the approved New Testament, but which were very evocative of the Russian soul. I read also our great chronicle, The Tale of Bygone Years. I read also Orison on the Downfall of Russia, and The Tale of the Destruction of Rizan. This exercise, the reading of my native stories, helped me to put them in perspective alongside the other learning which I acquired. In sum, it lifted them from the realm of personal dreams. Gradually I saw the wisdom of this. I made my reports to Marius with more enthusiasm. I asked for more of the manuscripts in Church Slavonic, and I soon had for reading The Narrative of the Pious Prince Dovmont and His Courage, and The Heroic Deeds of Mercurius of Smolensk. Finally,
I came to regard the works in Church Slavonic to be a pure pleasure, and I kept them for the hours after official study, when I might pore over the old tales and even make up from them my own mournful songs. I sang these sometimes to the other apprentices when they went to sleep. They thought the language very exotic, and sometimes the pure music and my sad inflection could make them cry. Ricardo and I, meantime, became close friends again. He never asked why I was now a creature of night like the master. I never sounded the depths of his mind. Of course I would do it if I had to, for my safety, and for Marius's safety, but I used my vampiric wits to gloss him in another way, and I always found him devoted, unquestioning, and loyal. Once I asked Marius what Ricardo thought of us. "Ricardo owes me too great a debt to question anything I do," Marius answered, but without any haughtiness or pride. "Then he is far better bred than I am, isn't he? For I owe you the same debt, and I question everything you say." "You're a smart, devil-tongued little imp, yes," Marius conceded with a small smile. "Ricardo was won in a card game from his drunken father by a beastly merchant who worked him night and day. Ricardo detested his father, which you never have. Ricardo was 8 years old when I bought him for the price of a gold necklace. He'd seen the worst of men whom children don't move to natural pity. You saw what men will do with the flesh of children for pleasure. It's not as bad. Ricardo, unable to believe that a tender little one could move anyone to compassion, believed in nothing, until I wrapped him in safety and filled him with learning, and told him in terms on which he could count that he was my prince. But to answer you more in the way you ask the question, Ricardo thinks that I am a magician, and that with you I've chosen to share my spells. He knows that you were on death's door when I bestowed on you my secrets, and that I do not tease him or the others with this honor, but regard it rather as something of dire consequence. He doesn't seek after our knowledge, and will defend us with his life." I accepted this. I didn't have the need in me to confide in Ricardo as I had with Bianca. "I feel the need to protect him," I said to my master. "Pray he should never have to protect me." "So I feel also," said Marius. "I feel this for them all. God granted your Englishman a great mercy that he was not alive when I came home to find my little ones slain by him. I don't know what I would have done. That he had injured you was bad enough. That he had laid out 2 child sacrifices at my door to his pride and bitterness, this was even more despicable. You had made love to him, and you could fight him, but they were innocents who stood in his path." I nodded. "What did happen?